Take a look at all the energy-boosting products in a convenience store, and it seems some companies would be happy if we never slept a wink. But there's a movement in the opposite direction. Products with names like Simmer, Unwind, and Lazy Cakes. That last one is a particularly hot seller, and Julie Rose is going to tell us more about it from member station WFAE in Charlotte.
Yeah, they are very...
Davida Griffin's a little wary of the fudgy brownies with the psychedelic purple package for sale next to the cigarette lighters at this Charlotte gas station.
What do you think's in there? Something not legal, I know that.
It's a reasonable suspicion. The label says Lazy Cakes are the original relaxation brownie. Even at $4 a piece, the clerk at this gas station says she sells about 36 a week. Just 5 months since Lazy Cakes hit the market, co-creator Tim Barham says they're available in 24 states and sales are doubling every month. But let's be clear.
It's definitely not a pot brownie. Things that are in this brownie have been used for years to relax. Melatonin, valerian root, rose hips, standard stuff you can pretty much buy at any Walgreens or Walmart or anywhere.
True enough, but look up Lazy Cakes online, and the secret to their initial success is pretty obvious. Rumors are rampant they contain the same synthetic marijuana compounds found in herbal incense products like Spice or K2. No surprise, Lazy Cakes move well in shops that sell drug paraphernalia. That's where Nikki D'Andrea got hers.
There is an effect with Lazy Cakes, but I wouldn't say it's comparable to marijuana at all.
D'Andrea is not shy about having tried both. It's part of her job writing about subculture for the Phoenix New Times. She didn't get high from the Lazy Cake, but she was shocked at how sleepy it made her.
I really did go to bed for about, I think, 10 to 12 hours after I ate that first Lazy Cake, so maybe I should have started with half.
As if anyone ever just eats half a brownie. But that actually is the recommended serving size. Read the fine print and you'll also see Lazy Cakes are for adults only and should not be mixed with alcohol or eaten before driving. It's the usual FDA-required label you find on dietary supplements, and that makes them legal. But Lazy Cakes are sold in gas stations by clerks who often have no idea these aren't normal brownies. They're packed with melatonin, which occurs naturally in the body and is a common sleep aid.
Eating the whole brownie would be about twice the recommended dose.
Anna Rouse-Dulaney is a toxicologist with the Carolinas Poison Center, where she says it's only a matter of time before calls start coming in about Lazy Cakes.
Carolinas Poison Center, can I help you?
In large quantities, Dulaney says melatonin can lead the central nervous system to slow down and cause trouble breathing. More commonly, people just get really sleepy and maybe nauseated. Children are at greater risk. There's been at least one report of a toddler in Tennessee eating a Lazy Cake and ending up in the hospital. National Poison Center data show melatonin prompts more calls than any other herb or supplement. In 2009, about 5,000 melatonin-related calls came in to poison control centers, most involving small children. None died, but the makers of Lazy Cakes have decided to put a not-for-children warning on the front label of their brownies. Dulaney says that might not be enough.
A child who can't read, who just finds this in the house, is at great risk because it looks just like any other brownie.
Still, she says it's not the most dangerous thing she's seen. 28-year-old Philip Hunt discovered Lazy Cakes at a shop in North Carolina last month and now eats about 6 a week. He says Lazy is the perfect name for them.
If I eat a Lazy Cake and the remote's on the other side of the room, I actually watch a channel for an hour or two.
Relaxing, folks, is going so well for the makers of Lazy Cakes. They'll soon launch a product with the opposite effect, caffeinated brownies called Upcakes. For NPR News, I'm Julie Rose in Charlotte.
You're listening to All Things Considered. So an improved jobs picture. The White House says its measures to stimulate the economy are paying off. Republicans, though, fume that Washington continues on a spending binge that must be stopped. And that's where we begin our weekly conversation with columnists E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Hi again.
How are you?
No government shutdown, at least for now, we learned this week, but the budget battle goes on. Republicans are saying that a new round of cuts proposed by Democrats is either unserious by one measure or nonsense. The two parties seem to be about $50 billion apart. David, first to you. Do you see a path forward that averts a government shutdown later this month when the temporary agreement runs out?
I don't see it, but I think it's there. If you look at the polling on who the country blames if there is a government shutdown, they blame both parties equally. So both parties have an equal incentive to avert a shutdown. And this week we saw a fair bit of pragmatism. So while I'm not quite sure how they're going to do it, I do think we've seen among the Tea Party pipes, among Democrats, some more flexibility than I would have thought maybe a month ago.
Where are you seeing the flexibility? I'm curious, because the war of words seems to be going on unabated.
Right. The war of words is the war of words. But if you look at how Republicans supported this package to avert the immediate shutdown, there are a few opposed, Michelle Bachmann and a couple others. But most of the Tea Party types and the ones I've spoken to have gotten lectures on what it's going to take to control spending. And they've become much more realistic, I think. And then among Democrats, you saw a split between some of the more moderates and Nancy Pelosi and the liberal wing. And there's a fair chunk of moderates who want to do it. Now, they're still far apart, but I think they both desperately want to avert a shutdown.
And EJ, we've seen Vice President Biden sent to Capitol Hill to try to work out a deal. Are you seeing one in the works?
I see a lot of capitulation right now by Democrats. I mean, what really strikes me is that the Republicans, I think, you know, the president gave a speech today in front of a sign that said winning the future. I think they're losing the present budget battle because the Republicans have built an infernal machine, $4 billion in cuts every 2 weeks. And I don't think the Democrats know how to stop that machine. And I've heard that they're actually quite worried. They have now put $10 billion in cuts on the table, and they've got exactly nothing back from the Republicans. They are denouncing them. And so I think, I'm wondering at what point will you hear the president say, wait a minute, you can't do $1 billion in cuts in Head Start and all these cuts in Pell Grants. And at what point are they going to draw the line and begin to shape the debate? And so and the other thing is, I just don't see the framework for an easy deal out of all of this if Democrats start putting up any kind of fight at all.
Well, it's interesting because the Senate Democratic leader, Harry Reid, is calling the Republican cuts mean-spirited. And I wonder what this says about perceptions of the mandate from November. If the message as it was originally taken was slash government, cut spending, in public opinion polls, it now seems there's a lot more nuance in what Americans really think when it comes to specific cuts. They don't want them. David Brooks?
That's right. That's why they need leadership. And one of the things that's happened among the Republicans is that they've come to town. The House freshman said, you know, we're going to cut foreign aid and we'll balance the budget. Then they got lectures. No, you really have to deal with Social Security and Medicare. And so they've actually taken that step. The Republican caucus is now basically committed to taking on entitlements in some way in next year's budget. And I think that's a heroic step. The country is not there with them. Even Republicans, even Tea Party types, do not touch my Medicare, do not touch my Social Security. It's going to take some national leadership to explain the actual realities. I'm not sure they've done that, and they're taking a perilous route. I do agree with AJ about the White House's odd passivity through all this. They really had a head of steam during the lame duck session of Congress, and they've sort of given all that away simply by playing rope-a-dope. It's kind of odd, though. I think they're playing rope-a-dope on Libya. I think they played rope-a-dope on a lot of things. It's a strange caution in this White House.
It's interesting, EJ, if you look, there was an interview that John Boehner, the new Speaker of the House, did with the Wall Street Journal, in which he said Congress should raise the government's debt ceiling. It puts him at odds with the feisty Tea Party wing of his own party. Do you see him having a real struggle to wrangle those new members in his party in the House?
At the moment, I see John Boehner pursuing a very clever strategy because when he walks into that negotiating room, he can point to these people outside saying, look, I'd love to make a deal, but give me more because I got to buy these folks off out there. So I think right now the Republican position is quite functional. And as long as we're just talking about big, vague numbers as opposed to the real choices that we're making, what we're actually cutting, they're going to be in pretty good shape on this. And that's why I think that the level of argument really has to be raised or else they're just going to keep winning.
And EJ, what about David's point that the White House should be assuming more leadership on that, on the big questions?
I think they're going to have to speak out at some point soon. And there's a lot of impatience among Democrats on the Hill, saying we're carrying all this. He's sort of triangulating with us, and yet his positions are actually more on the liberal side on some of these cuts. He really wants to avoid them, so he's going to have to do something.
Let's think ahead a bit to the presidential race in 2012 and how the Republican field is shaping up. There was a lot of anticipation yesterday for Newt Gingrich's news conference. He was expected to launch an exploratory committee. Instead, he launched a website, Newt Explore 2012. There are big money issues that he has to navigate around if he is to announce. How do you both see the Republican field getting in place for 2012? EJ, you first.
Well, Newt seems to keep exploring the possibility of exploring, and that's very Newt-like. I think that you may actually have a much smaller real Republican field than we've been talking about. I don't think Sarah Palin is going to run. I don't think Mitch Daniels actually is giving signs of running,
although
he'd be
Indiana.
A very interesting candidate. I think you have Mitt Romney as a front runner with real problems, the two big problems with the Republicans being he supported a health care plan in Massachusetts that looks like what the Republicans like to call Obamacare. And he has flip-flopped historically on social issues, yet he's got some real institutional support. He's certainly smart and looks like a president. Then you have Newt, who I think may be the most interesting candidate and is this odd mix of provocative and interesting on the one side and outrageous on the other side. Then you've got Tim Pawlenty. Tim Pawlenty could be the remainder candidate.
The former governor of Minnesota.
He's the candidate with the fewest obvious flaws and the least baggage. And what this reminds me of is the 1988 Democratic field. People called it the Seven Dwarfs back then. Tim Pawlenty looks like Mike Dukakis to me. And I'm from Massachusetts, so I don't mean that as an insult.
That's not a bad thing for you. David Brooks, a couple names I think that were not on
EJ's. Although Dukakis did lose the general election.
Noted.
Tim Pawlenty played hockey. I don't think Dukakis could play.
A couple other names I think that weren't on EJ's list, David. Haley Barbour of Mississippi, governor of Mississippi. I don't think EJ mentioned. John Huntsman, former governor of Utah, now ambassador to China, but not for long. Anybody else that you're looking at?
Well, I wish Mitch Daniels would run. I think it's an extremely weak field without Daniels in it. I don't think Newt Gingrich, do not let that man near a management job. Very interesting to listen to. Don't let him run anything. As for the others, Haley Barbour, a pretty good governor, kind of a good spokesman. Do we really think a former tobacco lobbyist from the South is going to win the nomination? I really kind of doubt that. And as for Huntsman, the guy served in the Obama administration. Not a great resume line for you're running in a Republican primary. I really think it's down to Pawlenty and Romney of the people in front of us. It's so sad to be narrow, so narrow, so fast. I don't think Huckabee's going to run. And so it's really down to these two sort of establishment figures around which so far there's not much definition or excitement. Maybe they can generate it. But so far, I'd say a lot of Republicans feeling some letdown.
And you agree with EJ that Sarah Palin, you think, is not going to enter the race?
No way. And even if you look at the polls, she'd do terribly. Republican voters sort of like her. They're not going to vote for her.
And it's astonishing how quickly she's dropped in the polls. I think all the speech around the time of the Gabrielle Giffords shooting really hurt her among Republicans, which is where it matters.
Okay. Thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
You too.
You
thank
too.
You.
EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times.
More coming up from All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Economists weren't expecting it, but they'll take it. At long last, the unemployment rate is below 9%. Just by a hair, 8.9.
The White House is ready to shout it from the mountaintops. President Obama is highlighting the new numbers.
Now, this morning we learned that the unemployment rate fell to its lowest level in nearly 2 years. Our economy added another 222,000 jobs in the private sector. That's the 12th straight month of private sector job growth.
Those gains were offset a bit by job losses in state and local governments, as NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Morning.
When Steve Schulte walks the floor of his company's manufacturing facility in Montgomery City, Missouri, he has a lot of reasons to smile.
You'll see a wide variety of things that we build here.
Schulte is the CEO of Porta-King Building Systems. They make customized modular rooms that go into factories. So when manufacturers are doing well, Portaking is doing well, and orders are rolling in, including one from an automaker that has Schulte downright giddy.
Let me put it like this. It's the single largest project that we've ever had in the history of our company.
In February alone, Schulte was able to add 12 employees, a dramatic reversal from a couple of years ago when he was forced to lay people off and cut shifts to the bare bones.
Feels pretty good compared to the last 3 years that it was a real struggle to survive.
Employment in manufacturing as a whole rose by 33,000 in February. Lisa Lynch, dean of the Heller School of Social Policy at Brandeis University, says the sector has added nearly 200,000 jobs since the end of 2009.
And that's fabulous because these are jobs that on average have higher wages, good benefits, and there's a lot of secondary employment that falls out from gains in the manufacturing sectors.
Other sectors that are hiring include healthcare and construction. Dennis Tarney is CFO of Lake Erie Electric, an electrical contractor in Cleveland. He hired in February, too.
I'm going to say 20 people.
All electricians. Tarney says Lake Erie Electric does work for clients in the healthcare industry, education, and some automotive. He's hiring because there's work to be done.
We've been fortunate that we have some very good people. And they like our work. And we continue to bid, and we do it the right way.
Just a month ago, job creation numbers in the monthly report came in much worse than expected. But it now appears that may have been the result of bad weather, not a momentum shift in the labor market. Bill Rogers is an economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers. He says seeing unemployment drop below 9% is a real psychological boost.
I think the key here is acceleration. The economy looks like it may be, you know, shifting from first to second gear or either second to third gear. It depends on your perspective.
The February jobs report was so encouraging. Austin Goolsbee, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, says he got a fist bump from President Obama.
The president was, I think, satisfied that the policies that he's been enacting are setting the stage for the private sector to finally stand up and start getting the engine really going.
But employers are going to have to keep the engine revving for months, actually years to come, for the unemployment rate to return to where it was before the start of the recession. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. owes China a lot more money than we previously thought. The U.S. Treasury has published new figures showing that China now owns nearly $1.2 trillion in U.S. government bonds. Adam Davidson with NPR's Planet Money team explains what this means.
There are a couple ways to think about the U.S. owing China $1.2 trillion. I'm going to start with the scary way. China could use their power as our creditor to wreak havoc on our economy. If China were to, say, sell off 10 or 15% of its U.S. Treasury bonds, that could be enough to send interest rates skyrocketing. That would destroy our fragile economic recovery. It would be painful for years. Just threatening to start switching their holdings away from dollars could send terror throughout the global economy. It's not hard to think, my goodness, China owns us. But let's look at that debt another way. To the U.S., $1.2 trillion is 8% of our debt. That's a lot of money. But look at that same $1.2 trillion from China's perspective. It's close to half of their government savings. It's more than 20% of the entire Chinese economy. $1.2 trillion is just a lot more money to China than it is to the U.S. And that means that the only way China can hurt us is to completely destroy their own economy. China needs the U.S. and the U.S. dollar to stay healthy, to keep growing. What we have is mutually assured economic destruction. Now, that might not be the most comforting phrase, but to those worried about China's rise, it should be a relief to know that, for now at least, the only way they can do well is if we do well, too. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD, as well as an online savings account and a money market account. Learn more at allybank.com.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.